Amen. All right, so we're going to be picking up in Mark chapter 11 and verse 12 here in just a moment. Let's get some review in first. What, through the first half of the book, what's the main question that we're trying to answer? Somebody other than Sean. Because Sean's answered it. Rosa?
Who Christ is.
Who is this? Who is this man, right? Is he the Christ? Okay. How does that shift in the second half of the book? The question's been answered, right? Because right in the middle, that's when Jesus says, who am I? And Peter's got it. So what's the next question that's going to be answered? What's going to happen to him? And the question doesn't really get asked. It just gets answered. Jesus keeps answering it. Now, that's true for the apostles and perhaps for some of the disciples. For the rest of the world, I suppose, it's still the first question. Who is this? And all the way through the cross, who is this? Okay, so what significant event did we cover at the very end of the class last week? Big moment. And we have Jesus coming into Jerusalem. And what is everybody saying about him as he's coming into Jerusalem?
Hosanna,
which is salvation has come to us, yes. What are they calling him? They're really giving an answer to who he is. They're saying he's the king. Here comes the king. Okay? And they're treating him like a king. All right? So from that point until Jesus is facing a crowd, I imagine some of these same people are in that crowd and they're calling out for him to be crucified. How much time transpires from triumphant entry to the cry to crucify?
5 days.
About 5 days. So what is it going to take? So everything we're looking at from now is within those 5 days. Okay? So what does Jesus do then when he gets into into Jerusalem? Here you have everybody's cheering, they're chanting, they're ready to anoint their king. He's riding in on a donkey. He comes into town, and what's he do? Nope. Looks around and walks out. Well, you have to return the donkey. The cleansing of the temple is coming. And in Matthew, it just puts them all together. Puts it right there together. But Mark shows that, hey, there actually was a day that occurs. I apparently was incorrect last Wednesday when I said that that was anticlimactic. I'm sure the climate was not what they expected, but it was anticlimactic. Those C's matter, I guess. Okay. All right, so pick up in verse 12. On the next day, when they had left Bethany, he became hungry. Seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. He said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples were listening. Now, if we were looking at Matthew, Matthew just puts this whole thing into one account. Mark describes this as it actually is the first part of the account, and then you have the second half when we come back to this fig tree later. So let's just deal with the first half right now. Jesus finds a fig tree, and what's he looking for? Why? He's hungry. Constant reminders. Jesus is human. He feels the things that you and I feel, desires the things that you and I desire. And so he goes to this fig tree. And I've wondered, since it says seen at a distance, I've wondered if it's saying, you know, he's walking down the path and he sees it along the path in a distance. Or is it he's walking down the path and he sees it to the side in a distance? In which case, he's now gone out of his way to this fig tree. And what do we find out about the fig tree? Two things. One, no figs. What's the other thing? It does have leaves. So there's a reason he's coming over to look at it. Why does it have no figs? Because it's not the right time. I think it's interesting that Mark includes that. It was not terribly likely it was going to have figs. And Jesus seems upset. So my question is, and it's purely a hypothetical question, is this here to show us that Jesus is mad at a tree?
He's at least upset with the tree.
Well, he's just cursed it. Why? Is it just about Jesus and the tree? There are witnesses there, right? It says the disciples are listening to this whole thing. What's the point of Jesus and the tree? Well, that's an interesting thing. We're going to come back to that one because we're going to see the tree dead. But right now, we don't see the tree dead. We just see Jesus coming, looking for figs, not finding figs, and cursing the tree. What are we supposed to get from that, Emily?
I don't know if this is correct. This is one that I take from it, is that Jesus desires productivity. He desires there to be something to show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is the message in Hebrews chapter 6. God puts forth all this effort and this work. He expects something to come from it. And if it doesn't come from it, well, then what's this fig tree good for if it doesn't bear figs?
So it's reflective of the Jewish society?
I think it's a statement of what he's finding in Jerusalem. God has sent prophet after prophet. He has given them the law. He expects to see good fruits from them. Instead, in 1 week, they're going to crucify the Son. Okay, so then we keep going. Verse 15, we'll come back to that tree. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were buying and selling in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who were selling doves. And he would not permit anyone to carry merchandise through the temple. And he began to teach and say to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a robber's den?" The chief priests and the scribes heard this and began seeking how to destroy him, for they were afraid of him, and the whole crowd was astonished at his teaching. So now Jesus comes back to the temple, having have observed it the night before. He comes back and he kicks who out? Who's he kicking out?
Money changers.
Money changers. Who are the money changers? What's their job?
Bankers. Sell sacrifices.
No, the money changers aren't selling the sacrifices. What they're doing is they're making it to where you can give proper money to the temple. So you have to give a certain coin to the temple, and people don't have that coin, so you come there, you buy that coin to give to the temple, right? So he's kicking these people out who are helping and worshiping God. It's odd. Oh, hey, wait, what, Barry, you don't agree with that statement?
Well, yeah, they might be helping, but it's not quite what God intended.
Very true. So who else is getting kicked out? Josh, what were you going to say?
I was going to contribute with the dove sellers.
The dove sellers, okay.
But that's just, again, trying to help provide that sacrifice that's required.
So this is a case where, one, we need to get the proper coin for the temple. This one is we need to have a proper sacrifice for the temple. Who would sacrifice doves?
Poor people.
Yeah, it's poor people sacrifice. Okay, so they're getting kicked out. Who else is getting kicked out?
It seems to say everyone bought and sold.
All the sellers,
right,
and the buyers. Isn't that interesting? It's not just the people who are selling. It's also the buyers and one other group of people. Okay, go ahead and go someplace else.
Wasn't he upset because where they were selling, not so much what they were doing?
Let me come back to that.
Okay.
We're getting to that. One more group. Who else is kicked out?
Anyone carrying anything.
Anybody who's carrying stuff. There you go. That was quite a scene. I mean, you're turning over tables, you're kicking out anybody, you're selling doves, you're out of here. You're buying doves, you're out of here. Everybody. He's kicking all these people out, including the people who have, as near as I can tell, turned the temple into a shortcut. Because if you come down the path that he's came down from Mount of Olives, what's right in front of you is the temple. What's beyond the temple is Jerusalem. Now, you can get to Jerusalem, but it's a long way around. Or you can just walk right through. And so some people were just walking right through, and there was a great debate. Oh, what are we going to do about this? And Jesus said, I'll tell you what to do. You stop them. All right, now, Jesus says, what was wrong with what they were doing here? What's wrong with them? Okay, first it's supposed to be a house of prayer. Are they praying? No, they're buying, they're selling, they're carrying. Okay, what else did you say, Rob? It's a robber's den. How was this a robber's den?
Cheaters.
They're making profit off of their sacrifice.
Jesus is clearly upset with the method that they are using. But I don't know that a prophet is wrong, but did you guys get the how many of you got ballots? I guess we all got ballots. One of those things that was on the ballot just shocked me, where it was, we got to vote to make it to where the payday loans had to be, what was it, a maximum of 30% or something like that? It's like, apparently it was 150% was the previous maximum. Yeah, at some point we say, you know, that may not be righteous. There may be something where you are just taking advantage of people. So part of it is, Jesus is upset with the way they're conducting business. Is that all that it is? No. How do we know? Because who all did he kick out? The ones who are buying and the ones who are carrying. So what additionally does Jesus have wrong with what they're doing besides they're taking advantage of people? They're being dishonest, have a dishonest weight perhaps. What's the additional reason?
Business.
It's just business. Yeah. Well, and John records the first time Jesus does this at the beginning of his ministry, and he says it differently. He says, you've turned it into a house of business rather than a house of prayer. And clearly, by the fact that he's kicking out the buyers and the sellers, it's the same thing here. It's not all that there is to it. Jesus is making big issues over several things, but clearly an issue. So what does this teach us about Jesus when he cleanses the temple? What do we learn from this?
Have a relationship with him directly in prayer.
Okay. That there should be an emphasis on prayer. What's the temple today?
Church.
We're the temple. Think we should be a people of prayer?
Yes.
I should say so, Josh.
I think we must more of the intent that God's house is a place where you go to be with him, not to, in this case, conduct business or
well,
it's a reflection of your heart. When the church becomes inside of us, we reflect God in this kind of way.
Was everything they were doing wrong?
You know, one of those
no.
There isn't any one thing that's technically wrong, but it's the conglomeration of them that reflects where their heart really goes.
Well, this is where Gary was getting at, is some of it's just where they're at. Does Jesus cleanse out the mall outside of the temple?
No.
Look, there's a street right outside, people probably buying and selling. No, it's not doing that. It's where they're at. It's not just what they're doing, it's what they're doing where they're at. And it says something about who God is and their relationship with God. And so, yeah, there's a problem there. And, boy, there's an emphasis to me on that, is that, you know, we have the Lord's church. We need to make sure we don't change the purpose of the Lord's church. Because who takes that very seriously?
The Lord.
Yeah. Twice. Beginning of his ministry, end of his ministry, kicking everybody out, saying, fix it. We certainly shouldn't make the same mistake as they are now.
People buy and sell in the Lord's church today, I think.
Well, basketball court attached.
It says there's a lot of things that we should stop and look at and say, is this what God intended the church to be, or have we changed it? That's an important issue. Anything else on this? Barry?
It wouldn't surprise us to know that maybe got some extra money for having these guys inside. I mean, they're willing to pay off Judas, so maybe they had some income as well.
Yeah, but they're not kicked out right now, so I don't know. I mean, it's
that might be why they have replaced it.
Well, I don't know why they had the place there as to who they had to get agreement with, but I mean, why would you sell and do all this stuff right there? There's a simple answer for that.
Convenience.
It's convenient. Did that make it right?
No.
No, convenience does not make it right.
I see stores of McDonald's in churches today.
You know, that's funny because you go to some churches and they have coffee shops right in there. Maybe that should get our attention. Like, wait. I remember this. So is this the same picture of Jesus that most people have in their mind? That's something we're supposed to take from this. Jesus is complex. He's not just the, you know, everybody come to me. It's also, I will kick you out. Both sides. My parents were the same way. I mean, I would run to my parents and hug them and love them, and then I would run from them because they were going to whoop me. Jesus has the same things. Alex, what were you going to say?
I'd say these people got off easy because here's Jesus. Did he not just calm the sea just by the sound of his voice? Did he not cast out demons? So a little table turning over, you know, his anger, maybe that's an example to us that maybe we should have the...
Let's go even closer to what Jesus just did. What's the last thing Jesus said before he kicked everybody out of the temple? According to Mark. May no one ever eat fruit from you again. He's already in that mood, right? I mean, this is... They very well got off easy. This is an opportunity for them to learn rather than Jesus striking them all down and sending them straight to judgment. I also learned that being at the right place isn't sufficient. Is there any other temple in the world right now that is the Lord's temple when Jesus does this? Any other place in the world where you should be to worship God? This is the right place, but that didn't make them right for being there. You have to do things the right way. So let's say we go out and we find the church that is just like what we describe in the Bible. And we start sitting in that pew. Does that make us right?
No.
No, there's more to it than that. Okay, well, let's keep going. Let's finish off the story about the fig tree. So verse 18 introduces a theme that's going to run through here for a little bit. And that is the chief priests and the scribes, what do they want to do? Destroy him. And why don't they? They're afraid. Their fear and their intentions get repeated from here until Mark chapter 12. Okay. Verse 19. When evening came, they would go out of the city. As they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. Being reminded, Peter said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree which you cursed has withered. And Jesus answered and saying to them, have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and cast into the sea, and does not doubt it in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it will be granted him. Therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they will be granted you. Whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father who is in heaven forgive your transgression. All right, so they come back, and they find the fig tree, and what's the fig tree look like now? That's dead. It had leaves. It was alive. And now it's just dead. Okay. How does Peter respond to that?
Captain Obvious.
It is dead. Is that it? Is this a statement of fact? Peter just kind of likes to state facts. This is a cobblestone street. Okay, so if we were looking in Matthew, it just says that. They're astonished. They're amazed. They're looking at this saying, whoa, the tree's dead. All right, does that make any sense for them to be shocked that a tree died over a day? Why would they be at all shocked?
Because what caused it to die?
What do you mean?
Jesus tell it to die, basically?
But what did they see Jesus do? He's resurrected people from the dead. What else has he done? He's cast out demons. He's done all sorts of things to help people, right? Something's different here. What's different?
Something died.
This is the first time from our perspective. There's nobody being helped here. This isn't, you know, when you cast out a demon, yeah, that's not good for the demon, but it really helped the person. Who's being helped here? This is Jesus using his power, and he's showing my power is multifaceted too. I have the power of life and I have the power of death. I control what happens. So they're amazed, and what's Jesus' lesson to teach them from that?
Faith.
Stop being amazed at these things. Have faith. And then what's he tell them? you can do this too. Have faith, because God's the power, and so therefore what happens if we pray? And he gives the, I won't say the ultimate example, but it kind of is. I mean, says you can move mountains. I don't know what else you would have said at that point. You can move mountains. Is that an absolute? I mean, Jesus said, if you pray it and believe it, it'll happen. If you pray for a mountain to move and you believe it, it will happen. Is that an absolute? Everybody's, well, I heard some things in there. I'm not going to say everybody's in silence because I heard mumbling. Somebody mumble louder.
In Cripple Creek, they'd say yes.
I don't think that's exactly what we're talking about, but
I would say yes until I'm shown otherwise, because Jesus just said it.
Okay, yes until you say so otherwise. All right, anybody else want to go that route? Anybody want to take the no, it is not absolute?
Well, I would go with the idea if it's in accordance with God's will, because again, we can pray for things, and if they come to bear the way that we think they're going to.
Yeah.
It was his look. It wasn't really me. It's still God that's doing it.
The problem is I like Bonnie's approach better. Because yours is, while it sounds really good, as long as it's in accordance to God's will, that's not what Jesus said here, is it?
No.
So until we see otherwise, this is just an absolute. How far do we have to go to prove it's not an absolute? What? The garden? Okay, so 4 days. 4 days and we'll see it. You don't have to go that far. I can count the number of verses on my hand. What's the mountain he then describes praying and having it removed? You want to move mountains. What mountain should we have moved? What's the big issue? Sin. And so he says, pray for forgiveness. And what will happen? It will be forgiven. That's exactly what he was just saying. It's like, if you believe, pray and it'll be forgiven, except it's not an absolute. Why? Sean?
So I see what you're saying, but that example of Jesus himself submitting to God's will, because he could have stopped it, right? This was not a case of praying for this and I'm going to get God's will. It's a case of Jesus praying for it and submitting to God's will because he could have stopped it.
Yeah, we'll get to his prayer later, but I mean, yes, that prayer is, because the prayer has multi sides to it, God answers it in the affirmative, right? He gets what he prayed for, right?
I thought you were saying the example of praying in the garden is a case where this shows that this isn't an absolute because Jesus is
praying. No, that was Emily. You're going to have to talk to her. Here's what I'm saying. The evidence that it is not an absolute is found in the next verses. Not the prayer in the garden. It's found right here. Verse 25, whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is in heaven will also forgive you your transgressions. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father who is in heaven forgive your transgressions. So here he's just told us the power of prayer. And what's the next thing we should be praying for? Forgiveness. Not just for our sins, but for other sins. Why do we want forgiveness? Well, why do we forgive others? So what if I prayed for forgiveness of sins and absolutely believed God would do it, but I'm not forgiving others?
You won't get forgiven.
It's not an absolute. Immediate context shows it's not an absolute. But what's the point when Jesus says, if you pray, believe, you'll get? What's the point?
Pure heart.
Pure heart? Hmm? Yes, why? What's the faith good for?
Peace of mind?
Well, I would think that would apply. What can faith with God accomplish?
Anything.
We shouldn't be shocked or amazed at God's power. That is frustrating to God. He wants us to have faith. And so he is saying, look, you guys are shocked that a tree died. You need to understand something. You're gaining access to the power of God. And if you have faith, God can accomplish anything. You got to approach it with less shock and surprise. You got to believe what God can do. Is it believing in what we can do? No, it's a faith in God. And he uses the extreme, saying you can move mountains. Can we move mountains with God? I mean, God can move oceans. He created the mountains. Seems like it's not that difficult for God to move a mountain. How big is God in relation to the earth?
Minuscule speck of dust.
Biblically speaking.
On the scales, ages?
God answers this. The earth is my footstool.
Clouds are the dust of his feet.
It's tiny in comparison to him. Now, what's your problem in comparison to God? There's nothing that we can go to God with, and it's too big. And so he's teaching us to pray to God and to pray with faith and to not be constantly doubting. But then verse 25 and 26, he emphasizes, though, there is some responsibility on our part. And in this case, it is, if you want to be forgiven, there's something you've got to do. We got to be merciful to others. We've got to be forgiving. Alex, you have to raise it higher than that or I don't notice. Okay, fine. Were you going to say something? Oh, you weren't. Oh, I thought, if I was doing an auction, you would have gotten it. You went like this. Okay, let's move on. Verse 27. They came again to Jerusalem, and as he was walking in the temple, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders came to him and began saying to him, by what authority are you doing these things? Or who gave you this authority to do these things? And Jesus said to them, I will ask you one question, and you answer me. And then I will tell you by what authority I do these things. Was the baptism of John from heaven or from men? Answer me. They began reasoning among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say, then why did you not believe him? But shall we say from men? They were afraid of the people, for everyone considered John to have been a real prophet. Answering Jesus, they said, we do not know. And Jesus said to them, nor will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Okay. So the chief priests, they find Jesus in the temple again, and what's their question? Yeah, okay, so let's start off with do what? What right do you have to do what? Well, he is performing some miracles, and they may be asking, where did you get the power to do that? But I think a lot of it is, who gave you the right to kick everybody out of the temple?
Well, in Acts, chapter 4, you know, Peter and John are asked the same question. Who told you you could preach this thing? We're the guys that are under control here. This is Ananias and Caiaphas who killed Jesus. We're the guys to tell everyone what to do. What are you doing?
Yeah.
You don't have the right to do that.
Yeah, that's fun when it's about curing somebody first. Who gave you the right to heal that guy? Yeah. Like, well, let me tell you about him. I'm happy to tell you about him.
Do that again.
So their question is one of, who gave you the right? Because they've debated it. A lot of them didn't like the fact that the temple had become what it had become. They didn't like the fact that it was a shortcut. But what can they do about it? It's not their house. They weren't sure what to do. They didn't have the authority. Jesus comes and he has the authority. Well, or does he? Because he's just done something they couldn't do, they wouldn't do. And so they challenge him on authority. Jesus replies how? I have a question for you. By the way, they're going to learn their lesson about this one. Because the next time when we see them asking questions, forward in Mark chapter 12, notice what they're going to say. Verse 14, teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one. No more of this asking us a question first. No deferring. You answer. Okay, so they've learned from this one. But Jesus says, I will answer your question if you answer mine. Why not just answer their question? What is the answer to their question? By what authority does he do these things? I am the Son of God. I am the Christ, the Messiah, your King and Lord. Isn't that what he wants them to believe?
Yes.
So why not tell them? Marcus? I already have. And how did it go? Right. So why ask them a question? Why not just walk past them? It's like, I'm ignoring you guys. Bonnie?
Confronting them with their own inability to commit to truth.
And everybody else is going to get to see it. Everybody else is going to get to see this moment, because now he's going to ask them a question. And what is his question? What is it really?
Where did John get his authority?
Where did John get his authority? It's the same question, different person. All right? Where did John get his authority? Or the baptism of John, from heaven or from men? That's the question. Is the authority from God, or is the authority from John? Now, how much baptism is there in the Old Testament? More than what I think. How many prophets were going around saying you need to be baptized? Okay, there we go. None. So John is coming and doing something new. Now, if he's from God, what should the people do? Be baptized. In fact, that's what it's going to say in Luke. In Luke chapter 9, I believe, it says that they had rebelled against God, having not been baptized. That was God's plan. But if it's John's idea, should the people be baptized? This is a pivotal question. It's important. We can't just walk down the middle. We have to pick a side. We have to know, is John from God or from men? Because we need to know if we need to do what he's saying to do or to reject what he's saying to do. What had these men done? Despite what they say, what had they done? They'd made a decision, and they had rejected him. All right. So Jesus asks the question, John's baptism, is it from heaven or from men? And they reason. And what's their reasoning? If we say he's from heaven, we got a problem, because then it's really obvious we didn't do it. And he's got us. All right, what if we say he's from men? Which, by the way, is what they obviously believed, because they hadn't obeyed him. What's going to happen? People are going to turn against us. They are afraid again of the people again. And so Jesus, then their answer finally is, we do not know. Is that an acceptable place to stand?
No.
It's understandable to be agnostic, to be where I don't know. But that's not an acceptable place to stand. What do you do when you don't know? Find out. So they should have figured it out. They should have gone back. And what could they look at in the Old Testament to kind of give them an idea? There were some prophecies that were kind of pointing to John the Baptist. How many people, when John was growing up, thought John had to be somebody? A few? Or a lot? Remember, John's birth was not in private. His dad is a priest. His dad comes out and everybody knows he's seen an angel. And then, when John, for the next year, Zacharias can't speak, John's born, Zacharias' tongue is loosed and he's able to speak again, and everybody's asking the question that Mark was asking, only it's about John, and that is, who is this child? They knew he was somebody. They should have known. They should have known. All right, let's keep going. Chapter 12, verse 1. And he began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard and put a wall around it and dug a vat under the wine press and built a tower and rented it out to vine growers and went on a journey. At the harvest time, he sent a slave to the vine growers in order to receive some of the produce of the vineyard from the vine growers. They took him and beat him and sent him away empty-handed. Again, he sent them another slave, and they wounded him in the head and treated him shamefully. And he sent another, and that one they killed. And so with many others, beating some and killing others. He had one more to send, a beloved son. He sent him last of all to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But those vine growers said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." They took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the vine growers and will give the vineyard to others. Have you not even read this scripture? The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. This came about from the Lord, and it is marvelous in our eyes. And they were seeking to seize him, and yet they feared the people, for they understood that he spoke the parable against them. And so they left him and went away. All right. So Jesus gives this parable about a vineyard. And what does he talk about the owner of the vineyard doing? What? A lot of work. He starts off and he does a lot of work. He gets everything lined up. He even planted everything. But he's going to have someone else working on it. Okay? So what's he expect? He expects them to receive some of the produce, right? All right, so he sends a servant, and what happens to that servant?
He gets beat up.
He gets beat up. By the way, Jesus was quoting there in verse 1. He's quoting Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 2. If you go back and look at it, it's exactly what we were talking about with the fig tree. It talks about how he goes through and he plants the vineyard. He does all these things and then doesn't get any produce. And so then he sends off his curses on the people, on the land for not producing. Now Jesus is a little bit different. He's quoting that, but he has a little different point. So he goes to get the produce. They take the first guy and they beat him. They send him away empty-handed. The master sends somebody else, Ultimately, what do they start doing? Oh, they're killing them. Why would they kill them?
Well, they beat some of them.
They beat some of them, yes. Why are they doing this?
There's some flawed logic that they're going to get the inheritance.
There is some flawed logic to this. I don't know what the law is in regards to this. But why kill the servants? What are they hoping will happen?
The master won't send
them. Stop sending them. Or maybe the servants will stop coming. Because honestly, if I was one of the next servants, I'm not liking my chances here. I can see the trend. And so the master, though, he's thinking differently. He thinks, well, if I send them my son, how many of you think that was a reasonable thought? Parables fall apart at some point. They give us main points, but they fall apart. Here's one of the places where they fall apart. Did the Jews, and because obviously this is talking about the Jewish leadership and the way they're going to treat the prophets and Jesus, did the Jews kill Jesus because they thought he was the Son of God? No. That's why they do it here. Every parable falls apart at some point. This is not a parable about our God being insane. Thinking, well, they didn't listen to all these people, they'll listen to my son. If we were to do a different parable, what would this emphasize about God? Not his insanity that he keeps sending these people. What's it showing, Marcus?
Love and patience.
Love and patience. He keeps giving them a chance, an opportunity. Maybe they'll get it right this time. Maybe I'll give them the opportunities. It's not about him being thinking this is going to work. It's about him doing, acting out of love and patience.
Consider his long suffering as salvation.
So then he quotes from Scripture. He quotes from Psalm. By the way, remember this was what was being quoted as he was making the triumphant entry. They should know this Psalm. They were quoting it. What's this quote, what's this prophecy have to do with what he's talking about here? Saying, you guys should have seen this. You should have known. Look at the Old Testament. Quickly, Nick's getting ready to ring the bell. Marcus. Yeah, they should.
That's kinda, I think that's how that all ties together.
So what specifically in verses 10 and 11, what's relating to what's in the parable? Because it doesn't talk about vine growers here. It's the rejection idea. Saying you guys should have known that the Messiah, when he came, was going to be rejected. It's been in your book this whole time. And where is it coming from, this rejection, this plan that Jesus would come and be rejected? Where's the plan from? Well, that's the other part of it, saying it's from God. This is God's plan. And then I just laugh. Verse 12 just cracks me up. It's like you can just see them with fists in their hands saying, stop saying I'm violent, right? Isn't that what they're doing? They realize it's about them, how we beat up and attack all the servants from God. No, we don't. Get him. I don't get that. Okay. All right, so let's go on. Now they're going to try to get Jesus. Oh, by the way, isn't it an interesting parallel? We've seen these three times now. It talks about they won't take action. Why? They're afraid. They're afraid of what might happen. What's Jesus doing right now? Why did he come to Jerusalem? He knows what's going to happen. Isn't it interesting that they're afraid they might get hurt? They're afraid they might lose things. They're afraid people might go against them. Jesus knows, and he comes. The difference between those who are cowardly and he who is brave. All right, verse 13. They sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him in order to trap him in a statement. They came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are truthful and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why are you testing me? Bring me a denarius to look at." They brought one, and he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said to him, "Caesar's." And Jesus said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they were amazed at him. Once again, we see Jesus bringing unlikely groups together, the Pharisees and the Herodians. Who are the Pharisees? Remind me of this. They're what? Jewish leaders, spiritual-minded, followers of the law and tradition. And experts on these things. Experts on other things, too, such as breaking the law. But Herodians, who are they? Yep. They're followers of Rome. We're on Rome's side. Okay. So you put them both together to make sure you have the witnesses then. And, you know, be cautious of those who compliment. Not everybody who says nice things means nice things for you. So they say the nice things. "Teacher, we know that you're truthful. We know you defer to no one. We know you're not partial. We know you're going to teach the way of God in truth." And so then the question, is it lawful to pay a poll tax to Caesar or not? What's the answer to that? Yes. How do we know that? Because under the Old Testament, God would send them into slavery all the time. And now they're going to be paying to other people. They're not breaking the law by doing that. That was a part of the law. That was a part of the punishment of breaking the law. They just didn't like it. Because what did it say when they were paying a poll tax to Caesar? What did that say about their condition?
Slavery.
Slaves. They didn't like that. There was a Galilean, interesting, a Galilean in 6 AD who said, "We shouldn't pay that. We shouldn't pay that because we are not slaves to Rome." And of course, what's Rome do when you do that? Smashed him, but don't lose sight. He was a Galilean. And now we have a Galilean in Jerusalem, and they're asking the same question. They're paying close attention. All right. So if Jesus says, yes, it's lawful to pay the tax, what's going to happen to him? Even though that's the right answer, what's going to happen to him? He's on their side. You Jews, stop following him. He's on their side. All right, if he says don't pay the tax, what's going to happen to him? Now he's breaking the law. We're going to get rid of him. Either way, we've got him. And of course, Jesus doesn't just give them the answer. He deals with it more wisely, more prudently than that. And what is his answer to them then? Whose picture's on there? So give it to Caesar since it has Caesar's picture on it. And give to God what is God's. I think the big question then is, what is God's? True, God created everything. Though, he was a very specific question. Whose image is this? How did things go in creation when God got to man? We were created in his image. Give them your money. Give God yourself. Give him your everything. True message. True for us today, too. Don't worry about the political side of things. Give God your heart, your everything. We'll come to that next week. So we're going to pick up in verse 18 next time. And my hope is, I was shooting for a chapter and a half. My hope is then we'll get another chapter and a half and be caught up next week. So last part of 12, all of 13, hopefully. Go ahead, Nick. Thank you.